you a high performer, obsessed with growth, and looking for an edge? Welcome to Mind Body Peak Performance. Together, we'll discover underground secrets to unlocking the full potential of your mind, body, and spirit. We'll learn from some of the world's leading minds, from ancient wisdom to cutting-edge tools and everything in between. This is your host, Nick Urban. Enjoy the episode. Hello, friends. Welcome back to another episode of Mind Body Peak Performance. Today, I've got a deep one for you. This is a conversation with Jake Carter. Jake is a global educator and researcher in functional medicine and nutrition, and he's the founder of the Carter Institute. He has mentored and taught health professionals and coaches in more than 31 countries, teaching thousands through his seminars, content, and training. Let me tell you from talking to him, Jake is a wise soul with information on effective behavior change, ultimate routines, his be, do, and have model, his case against biohacking, his multifactorial approach to smart testing and decoding the human body, and a long list of mind-blowing stats about the state of today's world. If you find today's episode valuable, be sure to leave us a review and share it wide with your friends, family, and network. That's what helps us get found and how I continue bringing you awesome guests. Now let's dive deep with Jake. I'm happy to be joined tonight by Jake Carter. Jake is a global educator and founder of a disruptive educational model that's globally redefining health for generations to come. It's called the Carter Institute. Jake, welcome to the show.
Awesome intro there, Nick. Seems like you possibly asked someone about that before. Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure having me on here. I'm really privileged and I'm looking forward to the topics, what we're going to discuss.
There's a big time difference between us. It's 9 p.m. over here in New York, and it's, I think, about 9 a.m., give or take, over in Australia. Mm-hmm. And I usually start off with the same question for every guest. But so far today, what unusual or non-negotiable things have you done for your health and performance today?
Well, I say today, but the past couple of weeks have been a bit of an anomaly for me, because I'm on this mad learning spree recently. And when I go on these learning sprees, you know, like with your business, you have working in your business, working on your business, and working away from your business. Right now, there just tends to be a lot of events happening, a lot of summits. So I think last week I spent 20 hours at a finance summit with a lot of millionaires and billionaires learning about precious metals and other things, you know, of that kind of agenda. And then it just so happened, as soon as that finished, more or less, there's the e-com world summit. Hmm. And I don't run an e-commerce website, but nonetheless, you know, this is really the revolutionary industry, what we're experiencing right now. It's growing exponentially. And from that, you get to learn more about, you know, consumer psychology, branding, online businesses, and all these other elements. So that, because it is largely done in America, that starts at 9 p.m. Ironically, you know, the time of which it is there for you, but for me, and I guess it would be more or less 9 a.m. your time where it starts, and that runs through the night. So for the past couple of nights, I've been attending and watching this. So, you know, already I've probably banked up around 10 hours of research. So it was a late night last night, to say the least. You know, it was a late night, so it was just a smooth morning, and you know, I've got the fortunate ability of working more or less, you know, how I want, when I want, per se, because my career, my passion, my service, my mission is fostered around learning. So as long as that is the number one priority and my health is not quivering from the sacrifice of short-term prioritization there, then everything else is cool. But let's just say I've not been attending some summits, you know. We usually start off the day by waking up, and when it's a nice weather here, right? When it's nicer weather, we go down to the beach. It's just a 3-minute walk, if that, to the beach, and this is where we do our breath work, we do our humming, and We do some shaking as well and some tapping, you know, just to really work on stimulating the vagus nerve, the lymphatic system. Then we go for like a 5K run, come back. I go swimming by the shipwreck. And this is where you can see all the octopus and things like this underwater. It's beautiful. Come back, do my journaling for the day and either have some coffee or cacao or sometimes kratom. I'm not sure if that's legal where you are or not. But yeah, and that really sets you up for the day, because I'm digressing a lot here. But one thing what we need to look at is most people view their day from an exchange of time for activity, right? But it's almost a never-ending battle. Instead, what you can do, you can't change time, but you can change your energy, which enables what you can do with that time. So morning routines aren't just for people which are like biohacking kind of productivity superstars. They're onto something here, because by doing that, you really enable yourself to get into this flow state, similar to what Millay or Stephen Kotler would mention, is that that flow state enables you to get far more done. You'll be far more productive and you won't have those ebbs and flows with that lack of energy, which will stop you from using that time, what you have at hand, to your best use. So that's it, really, you know. But you know, I think it's a good lesson as well for the listeners, is sometimes in the idealistic perfectionist world, you know, it doesn't work. We have to sacrifice for whatever our values and priorities are. And that's what I'm doing right now.
That's something I talk a lot about, routine. And it can seem with these long drawn out routines that it's a waste of time. But if you think about it, if you're becoming five times more productive because of the things you've done, it's worth every second of routine that you do.
Exactly. Yeah. And I 100% say that I get at least three times more done in that singular day when I do that morning routine. And it's amazing. You know, there's a lot of structure to it, like the breath work, what we do there, going straight into the humming. So the humming mechanically vibrates and stimulates the vagus nerve and all these other factors. You know, it's key. It's designed and meticulous and in a fashion, in a structure for duration, which is right for me. But one thing what I also want to put out there is my routine isn't going to be your best morning routine. And most people apply this kind of fixation on what is the best morning routine. Well, the best morning routine is whatever morning routine you get the most from and what you can adhere to comfortably and consistently. And that will be your best morning routine.
So let's talk about that. What was the process of going from hearing about all these things, learning about the vagus nerve, to all of a sudden going around and implementing all these different modalities to stimulate it?
Over the years, because I've been doing this in this industry now for 13 years, you know, you start off by looking at, you know, training and nutrition, and that's everything, you know. It's like, oh, you know, nutrition's 100%. Well, you know, it's really not. The more we look into the psychology, mindset, lifestyle, they're the things which will influence your behavior. And when we look into your behavior, that's the subtle undertone of your consistency. And then if we look at your behavior and that's changing, your consistency to whatever you have at hand will also be possibly unreliable. So if we can look at almost manipulating your behavior by cultivating your lifestyle, that's going to be really worth its weight in gold. So when we look into this, the lifestyle is key. It's absolutely key. It's why when we look at the number of lottery winners, what there are, I believe it's around 70% which go bankrupt within 3 to 5 years after winning the lottery. Yes. And it's because they haven't adopted that lifestyle to understand and behave properly with that money, you know. And it's very similar to this beautiful concept here, what we teach at the Institute, which is the be, do, have model. I'm not sure if you've heard of this before. So most people focus on what they want to have, right? Like they want to have a six pack, or they want to have seven figures in the bank. And then what they focus on next is what they need to do to have that. You know, I need to do sit-ups, I need to do a diet, I need to work all day and all night. But instead of doing, we need to focus on being, okay? And the being enables us to embody that change and change our lifestyle. And it's just quite ironic that if you have be, do, have, you cross out the do, you put the be and the have together, and that gets behavior. So when we look into this, the more we start to analyze the human body, the consistency, the adherence, and the success from that, it's more about the lifestyle, the priorities, what they do and what they don't do, and how they do it and when they do it, which enables that long-term change for adaptation. So, you know, really it was just a process of realization, studying, which enabled me to value these changes more, because there's a difference, right? You know, it's like if you're eating a certain diet, let's just say you're doing a paleo intermittent fasting diet, but then your lifestyle, you're around people which aren't doing the same. And we know that you're the average of the five people that you spend your most time with. And we know studies say that it extends over 3 degrees of separation as well, which is quite interesting there. Yeah. But, you know, we need to really make sure that our environment is fit for purpose, because we are really a product of our environment. And that's done through lifestyle.
And when you were coming up with the initial ideas of things to test, that was mostly through your research, and then it was trial and experimentation to see what you did that you felt, and maybe after a week or so you decided this belongs in my routine and this should be cut?
Yeah, so when, and there's this big notion right now, everyone has a lot of excitement for the term biohacking, but biohacking is when health meets lazy. That's what biohacking really is, okay? And it's trying to outsource our internal physiological requirements to the advancements of technology, which, don't get me wrong, at the end of the day, we are in the 21st century. If we can cut corners, and we are living in a technocratic world, okay? The growth of technology is exponential, but the growth of mankind is just linear. If that, I'd personally say we're regressing in terms of our evolution, but that's a whole other conversation. But when we look into this and we start thinking, well, there's a really good quote, in fact, before I get into this, and it says that we have caveman emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology. So it's almost as if mankind is outsourcing their laziness for the expectation of health. But when we look at this, a lot of this biohacking, you know, you look at the red lights, okay, the red light therapy, you look at the grounding mats and all these other things. What they're trying to do is really mimic our natural ancestral encoded way of functioning, which is how we've co-evolved with the world. It's just that the world now is being suppressed and attacked from technology, in which we have to almost co-adapt to technology because of our mere lack of prioritization of values, which don't really put that in alignment with our day-to-day practice. So when we understand that and we think, well, how are we designed to feel, function, look, and behave, you know, and how can we take that further? That really comes into the simple principles of making sure that we have our exposure to the elements, such as cold. You know, we have our cold, we also sweat. We know that studies show that using a sauna 4 to 7 times per week reduces your chance of causing from all cause mortality, despite age, behavior, and anything like this. We also know that using a sauna 4+ times a week, it reduces the risk of Alzheimer's and dementia by 66%, and Alzheimer's very similar. And we can then look into the cold therapy, and we look into how, like, Eastern Europe, probably 100 to 200 years ago, they used to get the baby's cribs outside, and they used to put them in the snow, and the baby wouldn't be directly in the snow, but it'd be exposed to the cold elements, and that'd be great for the immune system, along with the sunlight to the skin. And then we could think about sunlight, right? We've got people like Jack Cruz, which is really the maverick here, is campaigning that whole awareness of sunlight. And we know that there's far more benefit to the sun than just vitamin D. And you look into the countries further away from the equator, we can see that there's a higher prevalence of multiple sclerosis. We look into the photoreceptors in our skin and how that really entrains our biocircadian rhythm, and that relies on that sun exposure there. And that's what 95% of genes are expressed from. And we can move on and look at breathing. Well, first of all, breathing out is the single bravest thing what we do every single day, because if we can't breathe back in, well, your life's going to be very short thereafter. But we know we do it around 20,000 breaths or so per day, but our body, biomechanical functions of our body are compromised, because the average adult human spends 18 years of their life sat down. And from that, You know, we have this inverted breathing pattern, this dysfunctional breathing pattern here. And our body's clever. It undergoes these compensatory changes to ensure that breathing is not interrupted. But in doing so, it doesn't breathe efficiently. And we can then look into breath and how that can really have this impact on aspects such as HRV. In fact, your ability to breathe out and exhale for a longer duration has a lead time for representing HRV change for up to 24 hours. So if you can measure how long it takes you for your exhale and how long you can breathe out, you can measure that and you can have a 24-hour lead time on if your HRV is going to change. And then we have all the other elements like grounding, and we have, you know, sleep, which we heavily underrate. And I personally think sleep is probably the best unheard magic what we have. And we looked at, you know, with the daylight savings, when the clocks go forward, there's around there's a 27% reduction, I think it is, in heart attacks or so. And when they come back, it's a 27% increase, more or less, or 24%. So we can see the shift there with our sleeping patterns. And we know that social jet lag, each hour of social jet lag can increase risk of cardiovascular disease by upwards of 11%. So we've got all these things, right? And we've come so distant from that. I could go on all day, but we've come so distant from literally how we're supposed to function, how we're supposed to move, how we're supposed to breathe, the senses, what we stimulate, the kind of world, what we live in. And when we reflect over that and we think, well, we've not had all this technology, you know, we probably didn't have chairs up until 2000, maybe 3000 years ago. It depends if you look into the Sumerian history and if you believe in that as well. You know, I guess you could say that with this chairs 35,000 years ago, but nonetheless, I doubt we sat on them all day. Yeah. So, you know, we just got to think, well, how have we evolved and how are we devolving? Because that's what we're doing right now. We're devolving as a species. Our attention span is now, in some studies, less than a goldfish. The average attention span now, okay, untrained and unaware, is around 8 seconds. And that's due to the integration of delayed push notifications and social media and everything else. You know, the online world is fighting for your attention, and there's a war going on. But it's just that we have these ancient brains living in this high-tech world, and we're just unaware of that the changes have to be made backwards rather than forwards. Long story for a short question, hey?
Yeah, I like what you're saying about biohacking, outsourcing, or attempting to outsource our health for convenience. Mm-hmm. The way I like to use biohacking is rather than outsourcing health, it's to say, yes, I know natural sunlight has plenty of benefits that I'm not going to get from any form of artificial lighting, whether it's a fancy panel, which I also use and like, but if I can't get outside, I'm holed up indoors and I have meetings and I'm going to miss the sunset. Then around that same time, I can flip on my panel while I'm in the meeting, turn my video off and get some of the benefits. It's not a perfect substitute. It's a complement, but it's that way across the board, not just red light therapy, but a grounding mat's probably better than never grounding.
Yeah.
But ultimately the pinnacle is realigning with the way humans evolved. So if you have the ability to get outside, you have bare conductive surface to ground on, that's probably going to be better and more effective than a grounding mat.
I completely agree with you there, Nick. And, you know, like, don't get me wrong, we do have red light box. We do have a grounding mat. I just think people think that that's the end of the road for them, you know, when really it's like, when someone starts the nutrition plan, they don't go, well, like, you know, well, what supplements can I take for fat loss? It's like, well, look, you know, we do have to look at many different elements. We have to look into your non-exercise activity thermogenesis, make sure you're moving. We have to make sure that you have a sufficient metabolic rate and make sure that the thyroid and your leptin's functioning. And, you know, then we're going to put you in a cyclistic deficit, which isn't going to be too catabolic. And then we're also going to have some preservation there for your health, make sure that you're not in a micronutrient deficit as opposed to a macronutrient deficit, the two different things. You know, we can't just rely on one thing. So generally, as a kind of an industry, I just see far too many people say, yep, this is it, done. Don't need to do that anymore because I've got this device. And I see that far too often. And fortunately for the likes of yourself and me, you know, we appreciate these natural elements. And, you know, don't get me wrong, there are many others too, but I would argue that there are more that don't respect the natural elements as well.
I'd agree. And I can tell from talking to you that you have a holistic, well-rounded, well-thought-out approach. And does that come from being in the health and fitness industry for over a decade?
So yeah, this is an interesting question. Well, at least an interesting answer. So when we look into this, you know, I initially was absolutely awful at school. I was at the age of 14 or so, I was smoking a lot of weed, and that just used to be my thing. You know, I just get really high at school, and I was terrible. You know, my grades were awful, and I didn't really pay attention. Plus, look, something within me thought there has to be more to just repeating what the individual is telling me in front of the class. You know, basically, school is entraining people to be this dogmatic, indoctrinated process, teaching you what to think, not how to think. So I was aware that there's some issues, and you know, I was also questioning. You know, I was probably getting all philosophical and shit from the from smoking too much. But I was thinking, like, how can the world be in the place what it is in terms of the lack of respect, lack of care, lack of interdependency, and we expect that the systems what they are teaching us are the ones what we should adhere to. So anyway, at the age of 15, I started working in a gym, and it was a snowball effect. You know, I started working in a gym. I didn't have any qualifications. They knew that. They just paid me £3.64 an hour. And, you know, I was doing what I enjoyed. And because I was at school, I had dyslexia and a speech impediment, believe it or not. And I was awful. So basically working in a gym gave me that newfound confidence. It gave me that shining light to the dark room. It gave me something where I could not just entertain, but thoroughly enjoy and help me find my passion. And it blossomed from that. And someone really realized that, you know, I started to become, one would say fascinated, someone else would say obsessed with the industry. And from that process, they basically invited me onto the end year of a college degree. I did that. And, you know, I remember at college, one of the tutors, when I went for my interview, he was saying that, you know, you're really going to struggle, Jake. There's a lot of people in here which are smart. And I was just thinking to myself, this guy doesn't fucking know me. Sorry, I'm swearing. You might have to put some beep words over this. Okay, cool. So anyway, smashed that straight out of college when at the age of 16. I was self-employed. I was working with, you know, people a lot bigger than me. I'm 16 years old. You know, I'm 9 stone, 11 pounds wet through. So when I was working there, there's people like in their late 20s, jacked up bodybuilders, tattooed, henge, and there's me, this small little developing teenager. So I was trying to really represent the product of what I was delivering back then as a self-employed personal trainer. And from that process, I had to, you know, really train more and more to try and look bigger and bigger and leaner to therefore attract more and more of the right client. But in doing so, I was overtraining and under-recovering because my lifestyle as a teenager, as any teenager is, you know, given the listeners' awareness of my habits, what I had at school, well, you can only imagine how they extended into my later teenage years. And I was going to a lot of raves and everything else and, you know, really not sleeping much at the weekend. So that combined with the overtraining in volume and frequency and intensity, I basically had a bulge disc in L3-4 and L4-5 at the age of, it was around 16, 17. Oh, wow. And that was, yeah, it was a derailing moment because I've gone from this very shy, very timid kid, which had issues learning and an inability to effectively communicate, to finding my passion, to finding my strength, to feeling confident and living my best life, to then have all that ripped away from me. But one of the strongest and most powerful quotes why I hold true every single day is that opportunity often comes misguided as misfortune. So when we look into that, that injury enabled me to stop training, and the only modality what I could control was nutrition. And by controlling nutrition and experimenting with that, I could manipulate my body. And I was experimenting with all these different diets, paleo, intermittent fasting, and all the rest, carb backload, and you name it. And I really got fascinated with a ketogenic intermittent fasting diet because I did have an element of orthorexia and body dysmorphia as well.
I can relate.
Yeah. So orthorexia is basically an eating disorder where you have the fixed fear of eating anything outside of your self-imposed parameters of healthful, which creates a state of anxiety, fear, or avoidance and sacrifice of normative lifestyle behavior. So anyway, I was adhering to this diet to some great lengths to try and hold what I would perceive at that time being shredded. But really looking back, you know, it was borderline anorexic, to be quite honest. You know, it got bad and I got injured again. Okay. I had an injury in my shoulder. And what's interesting, you know, because I did have some blood work done because my eyes were quite yellow and I wasn't that healthy. You know, my bilirubin was 47 and anything over 10 is a representative of poor fat digestion, possibly. Anyway, and then I was doing a ketogenic diet, high fats. I was having pain on the right side of my rib cage. I was waking up at 3 a.m., which in the traditional Chinese medicine clock correlates with the liver. Yep. And we can look into all these other things there. And, you know, there's a lot of indicators which show that our ability to break down, well, my ability to break down fat was, you know, questionable. And later in life, when I started working with a private laboratory, jumping on a few years, they paid for me to do some DNA tests and I found that I had an APOE4 polymorphism.
Oh, interesting.
So, you know, when we look back, it's really, really interesting how the map really represented itself from an injury in my shoulder, which came from scapular dyskinesia, where my shoulder blade couldn't function properly because I had issues with my rhomboids, and my rhomboids correlate to the gallbladder. And my gallbladder is where you store the bile, which helps you break down fat. And then I had an issue with the tendon, so a slap tear. So then we know that, okay, some mismanaged inflammation occurring there. We also could look into the lens of blood work, which shows that the fat digestion wasn't that good with high bilirubin. We could then look into the TCM clock and waking up at 3 a.m. And then we look into the subjective biofeedback markers with the yellowing of the eyes. You know, and it's really interesting how you got traditional Chinese medicine, you got DNA, you got blood work, you got subjective biofeedback markers, which all were communicating the same message, but I didn't really understand at that time until reflection many years later. But anyway, as I move forward, I'm injured. And, you know, I've found this new passion to learn and something what I can really dissolve myself into. And my learning spree really came from that injury, because that's where I found about nutrition, found out about the healing modalities of nutrition. And despite several different physios saying that I wouldn't be able to train again, I managed to do so and do so very well. And it gave me that respect, that realization, that awareness to what nutrition can yield. And from that relentless learning from being injured at that younger age, you know, I managed to really acquire a depth of knowledge at the age of 18 or so, in which I had the great opportunity to present nationally in the United Kingdom. And I was presenting internationally by the age of around 22, 23, I believe, and then globally by the age of 25.
Wow. I can relate. I had many of the same things, from the body dysmorphia and to the overtraining, under recovery with the injured rhomboid.
There you go.
And we're both big proponents of education, not necessarily in the traditional sense of going out, spending your entire life learning what to think, but rather looking around and learning how to think. And when I scrolled through the About Me page on your website, I was blown away by the number of different workshops, credentials, and different things that you've done so far for your education. What's your approach to education in general?
Yeah, so it has been a one would say probably hobby, and it's quite ironic that, you know, that question also leads back into, you asked me what I did this morning, and really technically this morning, in the early hours of this morning at least, I was learning. So you can see how it lines there with my lifestyle and who I am to get what I have. And yeah, I guess at this moment in time, what we're discussing this, I've invested over $250,000 into my education to learn. And the key is that my philosophy, my approach, right, is I appreciate everything within and without the human experience, almost this 360 degree viewpoint to the human body. We have to respect that health is symbiotic. It works interdependently. We have many different axles of the health wheel, and that ranges not only to things which we would commonly associate to things like mental health or gut health or, you know, detoxification health or biotransformation health, whatever you want to look at with the liver and the kidneys and the lymph. You do have lymph health, ancestral health, you have your microbiome health. You know, we could go into all the nitty-gritties, but nonetheless, there are many different axles to the health wheel. And if one of these axles breaks, then the wheel is going to become obscure, and it's probably not going to be a circle. It's going to start to more like a dodecahedron or something like this, you know? And over time, as one axle gets compromised, another axle will get compromised. So my view, my appreciation for the body allows me to really respect that, you know, I don't get married to methodologies. I appreciate that health is a physiological prerequisite to life. But I also respect that health comes hand in hand with happiness. And sometimes we have to prioritize one over the other. And from having that kind of perspective and those values, it's enabled me to really learn both conventional education in terms of conventional advances, maybe like blood work and DNA analysis and things like this, but also marrying that with traditional philosophies and, you know, really started studying things like TCM and elements of Ayurvedic medicine and things like that. So I've had the fortunate ability to find my passion and chase it down like a hungry lion from the young age of 15, 16. I think it was actually 15 when I started working in the gym, sorry, not 16. And from doing so, you know, it's when you chase that down, it just enables you to keep going and going and going. And I had the fortunate ability to bypass university, but I'm in the fortunate place where I'm able to educate doctors now and people with high credentials. Along with personal trainers, health coaches, NLP master practitioners, naturopaths, and the rest. So in terms of the courses, what I've done, there is a vast amount. But what I would say is the most valuable thing what I've learned on this way, not that that was the question per se, but the most valuable thing what I've learned is to do with self. Yeah, it's to do with how we function, feel, and operate, how we place our values and things like this, because you can learn all these different things, but if you haven't really analyzed self, then it's like trying to install some software onto an old computer. You know, we need to look at that computer and probably, you know, fix it up a little bit, maybe get a new computer, and that computer's you. You know, we need to make sure that you're good, you're able to function and operate with this. So you could have all the learnings in the world, but if you can't embody that, if you can't integrate that, then it's really of lesser value, let's say.
When you say to improve the self, I equate that to upgrading the hardware on the computer so you can install newer, faster software onto it. But what are those practices of upgrading the hardware?
Yeah, it's eloquently put there. I'm going to use that future forwards. The key thing here, right, is there's only two reasons why people are unsuccessful. There's only two reasons, no matter if, you know, that's a client working with someone or if it's a high-end businessman. There's only two reasons when it comes down to this. Learning teaches you a system, and you might have the wrong system, and that is one of the reasons. But the other reason here is the wrong story. So there's only two reasons why people are unsuccessful, and that's the wrong story and the wrong system. And we have to work on our story first. We have to work on our values. We have to work on, you know, the simple practices which are overlooked, like simple etiquette of self and etiquette of the social environment, you know, seeking to understand before being understood, as Stephen Covey would put this, or many other practices there.
Okay. Back on the topic of meta-learning and, I guess, identifying those spokes of the wheel, what did you do? Because I had a similar realization that when I was looking around at certain health complications, Western medicine has no answer to. But if you look back, some of the other alternative systems, such as Ayurveda or traditional Chinese medicine, and there's a bunch of others, they had solutions that were effective. And so mm-hmm. I started looking to those and saying, if humans have known these things for thousands of years, if Ayurveda had the concept of the mind-gut connection thousands of years ago, they're probably onto something, and this still has validity.
Yeah. When we look into this, we've really gone distant from how we're supposed to function, again, almost relaying the concept, what we were discussing earlier with the advancements in technology and our outsourcing of laziness to really attract the aspect of health. And we look into things like what's researched today, and we appreciate that there's a 17 to 22 year lag between what's researched and then takes 17 to 23 years before it's put into medical practice. So we can look into that and think, well, you know, that already gives explanation as to why 1 in 2 have chronic disease, 7 out of 10 deaths from chronic disease. In the United States of America, there's over 500,000 infants between the ages of 0 and 5, which are prescribed psychiatric drugs. We know that 1 in 3 males have infertile sperm. We know that 1 in 10 have ADHD, 1 in 10 have asthma. We know that the fertility rate's the worst in the world. We can look into the healthcare costs, and they're going to reach $47 trillion by 2030 for chronic disease. You know, these are just facts what I'm pulling off the top of my head, which I can remember because they're so powerful. And we look into this, and we can really think, well, you know, is our current healthcare system more disease management? And I would argue the fact that it is more disease management. And then we could look and think, well, from this ancient scriptures and traditional philosophies, we really knew a lot of things which we're only beginning to respect again now. You know, things like Hippocrates, the father of functional medicine, some would say, which was from 360 BC, stating that all disease begins in the gut, or that one man's food could be another man's poison, or things like let food be our medicine, medicine be that food. So when we take this into account, you know, we've almost come this 360 approach, and we ask why. You know, why have we wandered so far from the truth? It depends on how deep you want to get with this, but you know, we can appreciate that. I don't know if you looked into the Carnegie Report or anything like this, and the influence. What I think it was either the Rothschilds or Rockefeller. Yeah, Rockefellers. Yep. That's it. Yeah, the Rockefellers had on the university models and how they banned a lot of healthcare and told got on the board and really structured what was delivered in a university scene. And then we look into this, and we can, I think there's some very, very horrible regulations around naturopathy in South Carolina, you know, and there's still things like this which exist today. And then we look into things like the FDA recently banning NAC. You know, the FDA has banned NAC and said it was a medication, despite it being a nutrient. And then you look into the studies, and we can see that it's effective for spike proteins, and it's effective for SARS-CoV-2 and everything like this. But, you know, let's stop the general population from getting their hands onto it. Why? Because, you know, healthy people aren't profitable. So when we look into this, it comes back into the subtle message what I seeded earlier, in that, you know, I would argue that we're devolving. We're regressing, not progressing. And that's because we have really stopped our own ability to think, let alone how to think. We've just stopped fucking thinking. and you know, we have this appeal to authority fallacy, where we don't question what's on the screen in front of us, but we question someone which has spent a third of a million and 13 years of his life relentlessly learning this thing. And then, you know, one of us is healthy and the other one's not. The other one's on medication, the other one's vibrant, the other one's living the best life, the other one's living a life what they have been told to live from the society's paradigms. So it kind of puts things into perspective there. But unfortunately, you don't realize until you're on the other side of, you know, the way things were. And that's no disrespect to people which are allured or endured from the sweet lies to deceive them. You know, I fully have my empathy and compassion extend to them, but that only goes so far.
Yeah. And like you were saying, we've been outsourcing our thinking as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we really have. You know, it's we have these brains, and again, it's going back to that attention span, right? Our attention span is on average, from, you know, the unaware attention, is on average 8 seconds. So when we take that into account, it's alarming, you know, because if we don't have our consciousness, which is manipulated from attention, then you aren't being present, okay? And, you know, there's when people reflect over, you know, what is the meaning of life, you know? And, you know, people may say that the meaning of life is to love. People may say the meaning of life is to be, you know, and I more resonate with the meaning of life is to be. But then to be is to also be present, because then you are really being, right? Hence why present is a present. So if we can't be present because we're constantly distracted, then that meaning of life, you're not necessarily living, you're just going through the motions. You're similar to a cog in a wheel churning through, reacting unconsciously to the environment it's in. So when we look on that, you know, the first thing when people look on, well, what is the meaning of life? Well, you have to fucking live first. And to live, you have to be present. So to be present, we can't be distracted. And to really do that, we have to go back to our lifestyle again and manipulate that for our greater good. Mm-hmm.
On the topic of bodybuilding, we both, it sounds like, subscribed to similar things back in our early days. And I remember coming across the idea of calories in minus calories out, or move more, eat less, and you'll hit all your body composition goals. And then I also came across a dietary approach called if it fits in your macros, where you have free rein to eat whatever you want as long as you cover your macronutrients. It doesn't matter about the micronutrients, but let's talk about some of the things that you've learned and you've changed your stance on since the early days and your bodybuilding career.
Yeah, no, really good question. It is a really good question. And there's a couple of things that what we need to look into. Fortunately or unfortunately, well, I would argue fortunately, you know, coming from that background of almost orthorexia and being injured and controlling, you know, the diet to the great extremes and lengths, which really come to the sacrifice of my own health anyway. I didn't really step much into that calories in versus calorie out world. And within the industry, be that the health industry or the health and fitness industry, there is an element of tribalism. There is my way or the highway. Yes, this is my diet, this is my regime, and that's yours, so you're the enemy. Okay. When really we have to appreciate that one man's food can be another man's poison. So when we look into this, I didn't fortunately fall into that. But nonetheless, I still respect that, because the law of thermodynamics, well, that's the underpinning law of a nutrition plan, is the energy balance, right? Yep. But we have to also respect that calories in versus calories out is dependent on a delicate equation, which can be manipulated through physiology, that can be manipulated whether our thyroid is functional or not. Mm-hmm. And let's just take that for an example here. If someone is eating a diet completely deficient in selenium, which is quite easy to do in this day and age, they would have difficulties with the conversion of T4 through to T3, which would therefore lead to issues with their metabolism, which would therefore make the whole calories in versus calories out a much harder approach. So therefore, the calories in versus calories out is this relative equation dependent on the health of our body. This is why the health is a physiological prerequisite for any long-lasting and efficient results, be that functionality, performance, or physique. Now, when we also look into this whole calories in versus calories out, we have to appreciate that, first of all, nutrients dictate the language of our cells. We also have to appreciate that the micronutrients dictate macronutrient usage. And we can't really look at nutrients in isolation. So really, when we look into the quantity the body needs of specific nutrients, it doesn't determine the quality. Similar to how if we have this big, massive Boeing 747 plane, and we think about how much rubber is actually used on that plane for the tires, it's very small in contrast to the amount of metal. But you wouldn't be able to take off that plane or land that plane without having the wheels there. It's the same concept there for the micronutrients. We really do need the micronutrients to allow the macronutrients to function properly. And we could even go to the extents of looking into things like the mitochondria. When we actually look into the mitochondria, there is a whole array of different micronutrients which enable that process of energy. We know that there's 8 vitamins, 2 minerals, 2 amino acids, 1 amino acid complex, 1 organic complex, and 1 neurotransmitter, which enables the mitochondria to work effectively. And then the mitochondria produces ATP. Well, what is ATP? That's the cellular currency of energy. Well, then when we go back to the whole calories in versus calories out, really the calories out is the energy expended and the calories in is the energy consumed. So therefore, if we have, let's just say, inefficient mitochondria due to a micronutrient deficiency, again, when we understand the simple terms, what I've managed to articulate in the probably under 3 minutes, we can appreciate that the whole kind of glorified, bastardized equation comes at a shortfall. So don't get me wrong, I respect it. I still work with that. I do see calories in and calories out as an essentiality for cultivating a nutrition plan. Because on the other side of the fence, we have people in the health sphere, which are like, no, you need to do just paleo and eat what you want when you're hungry. It's like, that may work, but what if someone doesn't really understand the proper quantities of food? What if someone has been yo-yo dieting and their leptin is off track and the ghrelin's a little bit funny and they have loads of hunger, sluggish metabolism, and they need to really rein that back on track? Because when we look into obesity, you know, since 2013, the American Medical Association has labeled obesity as a disease. So, you know, we have to appreciate that to improve that, you know, a deficit is required so our body can really go and break down the fat fuel storages and utilize that as energy itself. When we look into diabetes, we also have to appreciate that diabetes, well, how can we support that? Well, a calorie deficit is going to be phenomenal for type 2 diabetes. It's going to be amazing. And we can look into many other things. And a deficit does hold its value. It's just that it is applied wrong.
Yeah. And like you were saying earlier, that a deficit with no variation over the long term will lead to metabolism downregulation and slowed, delayed weight loss. So there needs to be a little more, I mean, in my opinion, there needs to be a little more nuance than just, I guess, extreme calorie deficit for long periods on and with no variation.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's the same thing here. It's like we're looking to, you know, diet breaks, which are a phenomenal method. You know, there's the Matador study, which shows a lot of information around that. Some people say that it's not necessarily required, but when we look at the diet breaks anyway, it doesn't just provide this physiological relief where you can have a surplus of macronutrients, which may support the thyroid and leptin, which we know in studies it can, but it also provides opportunity for a greater macronutrient consumption, but it also provides the opportunity for psychological relief. So that enables more flexibility, more social enjoyment. And when we look into, you know, I've got a seminar called 10 Pillars of Health, the 10th pillar is communities, tribe. You know, and we look into the ancient scriptures here. We've got the Bible, we've got the Quran, we've got people sitting around tables, sharing meals and having this pivotal experience of sharing food and sharing stories. And this is really how the cities were built, from having those meals together. So, you know, it's something what we do require, and it is an element of health, which is that communal health. It's even in Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So it's important to not sacrifice that as well. But, you know, work that in there so it works with the individual for their life, but for their goal. And there's many different ways you can do this. You can even look in the process of calorie banking there, where you may provide a stronger deficit on certain days and a surplus on the others, and really look at the weekly total consumption of calories as opposed to the microcosm view of day per day.
In a previous conversation, we talked about some of the hidden costs of quarantine. And you wrote a book called The Fat Truth.
Yes.
What's that on?
Yeah. So, you know, when we look into quarantine, it does a lot of issues for the human body, which isn't really getting addressed. And I'm not sure if I've got the book here actually on this computer. I've got a new computer. But in a nutshell, we look into how physical inactivity is labeled as detrimental to health as smoking. That's from the World Health Organization. We can look into how, as I mentioned earlier, obesity is classed as a disease since 2013. Most people aren't aware of that. We can then look into the things such as the inability to get outside and get sunlight, which causes issues with vitamin D. And we know that vitamin D is essential for immune function. We know that the inactivity can lead to sarcopenia, especially in the older aged. And we can see that sarcopenia, where they lose muscle, is a huge risk factor for mortality. So therefore, if they're becoming less and less active, therefore they're more and more risk. And we can also look at the older aged as well, where their purpose is outside of their self. You know, they've lived their life, they've been there, they've done that. Their purpose is now, you know, coming from this very family orientated perspective, but then that's kind of ripped apart from them, and they aren't able to have that fulfillment from their loved ones, from those that they cared for and who care for them. And we really look at this from a multimodality approach, and we appreciate how inactivity can be a huge risk factor for disease. You know, the immune system can't function as well, the lymphatic system can't function as well, and everything else. And when we look at the quarantine, it is a huge, huge, huge risk. In fact, let's just regress our quarantine, right? Let's just think about it from this perspective. The biggest disease the world has right now is disconnection. That's the biggest dis-ease. When we break down the word disease, dis-ease, we are disconnected. We are disconnected from self. We are disconnected from others. We're too involved with that device in our hand, with our head looking down at the computer within 1 meter radius in front of our body, than what's going around us in our environment. We are disconnected. So when we go into quarantine, we are disconnecting further. Okay. And we can look into the rate of suicide. And this was already a massive issue. Massive issue. We know 1 in 2 experience major depression. We know that suicide is the leading cause of death for 20 males between the age of 22 and 45 in Australia. We know that suicide in the States since 9/11 has killed 4 times of the military versus when in combat. So suicide's terrible. And why are we experiencing this? You know, because depression. And I really think disconnection is a huge part of that. So the quarantine is only amplifying that and making that worse. And we're seeing this subtle kind of rise of depression, apathy, and also suicide, which is absolutely devastating, which isn't really being openly discussed. I spoke to, we had information passed on from someone who is a firefighter in Melbourne, and he was going to a suicide, I think it was every 4 days in his district, just to find someone dead in their house from the lockdown. So you look into this, and then we take into account that, you know, SARS-CoV-2, you know, survival rate, what, 99.93%, 0.5%, whatever. It's fucking high, you know? It's healthier than the flu. And we take this into account, and we're doing these tyrannical lengths of locking down the world, creating unemployment, creating mass debt, creating a high level of inflation, which is ruining the economy for not only us, but for our generations to come. At the cost of what? You know, that's a big question.
One thing you mentioned multiple times is the power of community. And we know from some of the work on the so-called blue zones, the longevity hotspots around the world, the community is one of the most vital components of health. It's not diet, not sleep, not exercise, but community of all things. Don't get me wrong, others are important too. But if the most important, or at least one of the most important components of health, is being completely cut off and restricted, you have to wonder if it's worth it.
And if we just touch on this, right, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we have Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and at the bottom there's physiological, the second the safety needs, there's love and belonging, there's esteem, there's self-actualization. So when we're going to the safety needs from our encoded way of functioning, that relies on community, because we need to be able to have the strength in numbers. Then we're going to love and belonging, evidently that is community, okay? Now, when we extend from that, we can look into our stress response. And this really has a built-in mechanism for resilience, which is human connection. And when we actually have that human connection, we release oxytocin. And it's quite interesting, because oxytocin is released when we are stressed, and that can really help to vasodilate arteries, which would normally vasoconstrict. And it can help to repair damaged cells on the heart. Mm-hmm. And it also creates social intimacy. And then when we look at caring for others, the caring itself creates resilience. So high stress has basically been found to have an increased risk for mortality by 30%. But the individuals which cared for other people were completely unaffected by their stress. So it shows you how much that caring has this huge benefit for human health. And then we could even go into the Rat Park study with addiction. And this is a fantastic study where they had a rat cage, and they had two different feeding tanks. You know, they had water and one with, which I always believe, morphine. And when the rat was in isolation, it would just keep on drinking the morphine, taking its hit, and then die. Now, when there was things there to keep the rat entertained, where they could, you know, have others around and other factors, none of the rats chose the morphine, and they chose the water instead, which shows that community was able to override that addiction. And it also showed, you know, back in, I think it was Vietnam, when a lot of the troops were sent over to Vietnam, and many of them were smoking a lot of opium and things like this, they were worried about on the mass rates of addiction when the troops would come back. And they actually found that those which had family and belonging and community, when they came back, they were not addicted. So you look into this, you know, we look at this disconnection, what we have, and this disconnection feeds that replacement, and it does so with addiction. But addiction to what? Addiction to social media, addiction to hedonic behaviors, addiction to short-term gratification, bad food choices. You know, we just outsource that neurological capability for a short-term hit with a surge of serotonin with the risk of our health.
In addition to the social accountability of being in a community, like if it's easier to stick to a diet, to do your exercise, to break your addictions, if you have those around you that you care about supporting you.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess that comes back into my whole viewpoint at the start, right? Which is, you know, that be, do, have model, who do you need to be, and manipulating your environment and your lifestyle to enable the result, which you are a product from your environment.
I have a couple more questions before we go on to the rapid fire round.
Yeah, cool. Yep.
So going back to what we were talking about earlier, the spokes of the wheel, what are you most interested in learning these days?
Right now, for this relative moment in time, finances. We look into the rate of inflation and the amount of bankruptcy, the amount of debt, what the world is just growing. There's going to be a huge collapse of the economy very soon. So it's about protecting yourself, you know, and protection this day and age doesn't really come from how sharp you can make your spear and how far you can throw it. It really comes from a buffer of capital. And, you know, that is wealth. And it's important to make sure that you have a diversified portfolio and you're not just reliant on the system at hand to look after that for you. So, you know, ensuring that it's diversified, possibly looking into things like maybe silver, maybe looking into certain cryptocurrencies and respecting that one may fall, but you have stability in the other. That is my relentless area of research right now, because it is at this pivotal, crucial point where you can not only just protect yourself, but platform yourself.
And that's why even pulling the late nights and sacrificing some of that hard-earned sleep.
Mm-hmm. Short-term sacrifice for long-term gain in this case.
Exactly. Where can those that are interested connect either with you or the Carter Institute?
Yeah, cool. So this year, I've really been MIA, Jason Bourne, from social media. It's because the Institute is just absolutely exploded. The Institute, just so I can briefly explain that, is all-encompassing of my knowledge, my hardship, my pains, mistakes, my lessons thus far of this industry. And it's this umbrella of the 25-plus online courses, which are decorated with over 1,000 different medical references. There's hundreds of hours there, starting from ground zero, teaching students all the way up to the highest level of capacity in terms of integrating blood work and things like this. So it enables you to really be the best coach there is out there, create industry-leading coaches from a health-first approach, as opposed to just surface level. And with that, you know, we have things like the mentorship calls, which enables that integration, that pace setting, teaching you the hows, whys, ifs and buts, but enabling you to quantum leap that information and put it into your business to support your client. We also have the community support forum for that kind of interdependency with industry leading coaches from Switzerland, from Lebanon. We got two students met up the other day in Athens. We got students in the UK, students in America, students in Australia. You know, I have students from 31 different countries. So there's a few. Yeah. And I teach in 9. Physically. So when we look at this, it's this multifactorial approach by design to support a multifactorial perspective of health. And it is really designed to look at the health of your clients, the health of your business, but also the health of you. So in a nutshell, that's what it is. And yeah, this really launched at the start of the year and it's exploded. So all of my intensity care support has been into the students to make sure they are earning more than they could possibly think of, to make sure they are getting that level of fulfillment, to make sure they are getting that passion, but also to make sure they're healthy. So that's where my attention and presence has been. But you know, the best way to truly contact me is Katarina@CarterInstitute.com. That's not my kind of alter ego name. That's my partner. She's the global heads of operation for the Carter Institute. It's spelled K-A-T-A-R-I-N-A. Alternatively, there is Jake@CarterInstitute.com, but chances are you're not going to be able to reach me on that. I do have my social media platform, Coach Jake Carter. And the stuff what I was discussing previously, they were deleting around 2,000 to 4,000 followers per week at one stage. And that just puts things into relative context to the information what we have and the inability to comfortably access it. But there is that website there. There's also my website, www.coachjakecarter.com. And there's also Carterinstitute.com as well. But the best bet is to just to reach out and go to the Instagram page, hit the email button, that'll go straight to Kat.
And again, all these links, emails will be in the show notes.
Beautiful.
Okay, so now imagine that they're deleting more than 2,000 followers a week. In fact, all information on Earth is disappearing, but you get to save 3 most impactful teachers. Who would you choose?
See, so teachers is a very good question, okay? And I guess you got different ways of thinking about this, right? Because if you can only pick 3 teachers, and again, thinking about this on a very deep level, but you don't want a teacher for each respective, you don't want 3 teachers in the same field of knowledge, okay? Because it means the world's future forwards is going to be very limited to its processes of thinking. So actually you want a diversity of areas of knowledge and a diversity of teaching styles to really connect, move, touch, and inspire as many people as possible. So it's a very good question what you have there. I would personally pick something like, again, it's digressing completely, but I'd pick someone for mindfulness and appreciation there. And if we go back into this, we have Ram Dass might be quite cool. Yeah. So Ram Dass would be a good one there. Do you know who Albert Hoffman is?
Sounds familiar.
I'd pick Albert Hoffman. He's the guy which created LSD.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, you know, because I personally think, you know, when we look at the dissolvement of the ego, we look at that ego death, the ego death stops the preservation of self and helps the benefit of others. So technically, you know, with this strategy, what I'm going for here, I'm going for mindfulness to create a better appreciating community of love, nurture, and respect. We've got someone which can actually help people break through their self-limiting beliefs and perceptions of self and things like this, you know, so we've got him there. Which would go hand in hand with Ram Dass, you know. And then we need someone for survivalship, right? We need someone which can teach us how to live in this modern day world without the reliance on the system. And from the summit where I recently attended, I think there's someone called Jack Sparko. I only watched an hour of this guy, and I loved the stuff what he was saying. I loved the stuff what he was saying, how he thinks, how he functions, and, you know, enabling that survival. So if we looked at this, where it comes to the extent where censorship was so drastic, okay, my viewpoint here is to think, how can we survive and thrive? And we have to change our perception of values. And how do we do that? By becoming more peaceful, becoming acceptance and at peace within. And that kind of self-aware, social aware. And then we just got Albert Hoffman there just to help people radically, you know, break through those barriers. And then we got someone which can help us survive, you know, out in the sticks and the wilderness in this day and age. And that's how I would do it. You know, I'd think for a kind of a happiness, but also health kind of perspective on surviving.
Awesome. That's the most elegantly thought out and planned saving of teachers.
Yeah. Because if people are like, you know, like my initial thought would be like, you know, Stephen Covey, fantastic. But don't get me wrong, that's some really good stuff there. It's probably one of the biggest books that's changed my life. And I don't really read books because of the dyslexia. But really, when we think about it, if it's coming to the extent where all the books are burnt and it's coming to that mass level of tyrannical censorship, which could possibly happen, we need to be able to find peace within, but also survival from the world as well.
Yeah. Okay, on to the rapid fire round. What's the best or worst advice that you've received?
If we can reframe that as a lesson.
Yeah.
And that lesson's always come from hardship. So the best and worst lessons what I've ever had have been the worst lessons which have turned to the best outcomes. So it comes back to that quote, that opportunity often comes misguided as misfortune. And I would say that is the best, but also the worst lesson. So it's an answer for both sides of that question.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. That's good. Jake, what's one thing that your tribe doesn't know about you?
I'm pretty transparent, you know. I don't pretend to be someone I'm not. As you can see, I'm pretty laid back. I'm quite open. And anyone which communicates to me on a personal level or, you know, within the Institute, they'll know that I respect psychedelics. That doesn't mean I go out and abuse them. But, you know, again, going back to who I was in those younger years, right, at the age of 14 and just blazing through school, you know, I managed to find psychedelics at a very young age, at the age of 15 or so. And I've had my fair experience with them. And the thing is, when we look into psychedelics, they are not to be abused as a drug. They are to be utilized as a medicine to enable that platform, to enable that introspection, to do so with guidance in the right set and setting. But I truly believe that, you know, there are some beauties there. And I've got a seminar on psychedelics. One of my friends is actually a lecturer in a university on them. And we can look into, you know, the success of PTSD, depression, anxiety, you know, with things like 5-MeO-DMT and treatment-resistant depression being affected with psilocybin. We can look into, you know, the whole sphere of that. And they really are some powerful medicine provided from nature.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of emerging research on psychedelics being used therapeutically these days.
Yes, there really is. You know, I personally think that will be the next boom. You know, after the CBD boom, which has boomed exponential, I'm interested in the psychedelic boom. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, how would you like to conclude our journey together tonight or today for you?
Yeah, no. So first of all, I want to say thank you. You know, you've asked some very good questions, which have enabled a great level of introspection. Upon reflection over this, I do find that there has been a subtle message throughout. And I guess that message is to focus on being and work with your lifestyle. And it's short, sharp, and sweet, but it really enables a diversity of results depending on how you apply that, who, where, when, and other factors there too.
Boom. Well, Jake, you're obviously a deep thinker, and I've had a pleasure having you on the show tonight, getting to know you, your approaches, who you'd save, who you wouldn't save, and I look forward to staying in touch.
Likewise, Nick. I really do appreciate that, and thank you so much for such an amazing podcast. It really has been a pleasure.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode. Head over to Apple Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts and leave a rating. Every review helps me bring you thought-provoking guests. As always, you can find the show notes for this one at mindbodypeak.com/episode. There, you can also chat with other peak performers or connect with me directly. The information depicted in this podcast is for information purposes only. Please consult your primary healthcare professional before making any lifestyle changes.